Just like to welcome you all tonight. We have a really wonderful guest, Sandra Elix Katz, who has come tonight to talk about his new book, The Art of Fermentation, but also a couple of other interesting issues. Before we start, I just want to give a really big thanks to Mann Library for providing this space to us and all of the work that the New World Agriculture and Ecology Group has done to plan both this event and several other events in Ithaca. I'd also like to thank the Graduate and Professional Student Assembly for funding Sandor's visit here. So thanks has to go to that. I'm also just really pleased to introduce Sandor Katz. He's a self-taught fermentation experimentalist, and he wrote this book, Wild Fermentation, The Flavor, Nutrition, and Craft of Live Culture Foods, in 2003, which Newsweek called the Fermenting Bible. And it's interesting, a lot of people were introduced to their home fermentation projects just by reading a couple of recipes in this book. But it's not just the recipes, it's also the stories and the history that go along with why people would make things in their home as opposed to buying them at a store, or why they would buy things in a store as a complement to other nutritional and dietary aspects of their lifestyle. So Sandor wrote this book in order to share his fermentation wisdom that he had learned and demystify home fermentation. And since its publication in 2003, Katz has taught hundreds of fermentation workshops across North America and beyond, and taking on a role that he describes as a fermentation revivalist, or a cultural revivalist. Now, in The Art of Fermentation, his new book, with a decade more of experience behind him, the unique opportunity to hear countless stories about fermentation practices and answering thousands of troubleshooting questions, he's sharing a more in-depth exploration of the topic. So Sandor Katz has also authored this book, The Revolution Will Not Be Microwaved, Inside America's Underground Food Movements. He wrote it, it was published in 2006, and at that point I met Sandor in California when I invited him to Mills College, where I was an undergrad, and he did a kimchi workshop and a talk about food activism. So tonight our talk is going to be about food activism as a liaison with fermentation. We hope that this series of talks that Sandor has done in Ithaca will inspire future collaborations and celebrations of fermentation in Tompkins County, because we actually have a ton of cultural revivalists right here in Tompkins County, doing various fermented foods, pickling, beverages, all sorts of foods that preserve not only the food itself, but our food culture. So I really encourage everyone to take a look at this table on the right-hand side, maybe after the talk, after our question and answer, because there's more information there about ways to plug into fermentation right here in Tompkins County, including a new website/blog where you can send in stories about foods that you've fermented or interests that you have in other foods. It's called Find Your Ferment, and it's at the Cayuga Street Kitchen blog. So please check that out. But really, this talk is meant to be a starter culture for a larger movement that we see happening in Ithaca. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Sandor Elix Katz.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Shoshi, for that introduction and for organizing all of this and the rest of the group that you got involved in organizing all these events, and thank you all for coming out today. It's a special honor for me to be here at Cornell University for two different reasons. One is that my father graduated from Cornell University in 1955, and actually people the last few days have been asking me what he studied here, and I didn't even know, but I called him this afternoon to ask him what his major was when he went to college here, and he was a political science major. And the other reason why it's special for me to be at Cornell University is that, you know, the most comprehensive book that has been written about the topic of fermentation in the English language was edited by a Cornell food science professor who has passed on, Keith Steinkraus. And so, you know, that his book, The Handbook of Indigenous Fermentation Processes, has been just an indispensable research for me in my research. So it's really an honor to be here at Cornell. Now, mostly what I do is I teach people how to make sauerkraut, and I have to say that I feel a little bit naked standing in front of a group of people without a knife and a cutting board and a head of cabbage, and really like what I love doing more than anything else is just sharing skills, and that's what my that's what my books are really all about. But I want to use this time here today, and I don't want to talk for too long because it's really it's more fun for you and more fun for me if we have more of an interactive exchange. But there's sort of like three big themes that I've been thinking about in relation to fermentation, and one I would say is evolution, one is culture, and one is community. So I'm going to briefly address fermentation as it relates to each of these three huge broad themes. So let me start with evolution. There's a huge amount of speculative literature theorizes about the idea, how did humans invent fermentation? How did people figure out how to make alcohol? Humans did not invent fermentation. It would be far more accurate to turn it around and say that fermentation invented humans. I don't know, maybe we have some creationists in the room, but if you subscribe to the theory of evolution, all life is descended from bacteria. It seems like the emerging idea is that it was a symbiosis between fermenting bacteria and other early microorganisms gave rise to the first eukaryotic cells, the cells of which animals, plants, and fungi are composed. And so the corollary to the idea that all life is evolved from bacteria is that no life has ever lived without bacteria. So, in our own human bodies, bacteria are absolutely essential. Despite the cultural indoctrination that all of us have received, that bacteria are bad, bacteria are dangerous, we want to kill all the bacteria, we want to buy soaps that promise to kill 99.9% of bacteria, it is not really desirable for us to kill all the bacteria. We couldn't survive without bacteria. Bacteria play all sorts of essential roles in our physiology and our functioning. But bacteria synthesize nutrients that are essential to us. Bacteria enable us to digest nutrients that we wouldn't otherwise be able to digest. Bacteria make nutrients bioavailable to us. Bacteria protect us from the really fairly limited number of bacteria that have the potential to make us sick. There's just all of this sort of emerging information about all of the ways in which our gut bacteria mediate other immune responses and other kinds of physiological processes. I mean, recently there was an exciting new report that found that when a person fights a lung infection, it's actually gut bacteria that are mediating that immune response. So clearly bacteria are very important to human beings and really to all animals. Now, thinking about plants, you know, plants are no less dependent upon bacteria than we are. And so, so no plant lives in a sterile environment. There is no sterile environment other than, ones created through, extraordinary means in university campuses and government facilities. But, everywhere else, there's just all sorts of microorganisms. There's also no such thing as singular microorganisms. You never find, a single species of bacteria, a single species of mold. Like, they just don't exist in the natural world. Thinking about plants and bacteria, and then humans harvesting plants to eat them, we're never just eating the plants. We're eating the plants and the bacteria. And then, especially once we start thinking about how to store food, as human beings, moved from, migratory hunter-gatherer societies where each day people were engaged in procuring the food resources to get them through that day, once people started thinking about storing food, it just becomes all about how do you work with the bacteria? How do you dry food effectively so that it prevents bacteria from consuming the dead plant material that you're going to eat? People just inevitably observed, under different types of storage conditions, different things happened to their food. For instance, just picturing a contemporary vegetable, a head of cabbage. If you take a piece of cabbage and leave it on your kitchen counter, you could leave it there for 2 days, you could leave it there for 2 weeks, you could leave it there for 2 months, you could leave it there for 2 years, and it is never going to turn itself into sauerkraut. There are a multitude of different types of organisms on that head of cabbage. If you leave it just sitting on the counter exposed to air, what's going to happen, and I'm sure I'm not the only one in this room who's ever had an experience like this, is you'll get dark colored molds growing on the cabbage, and if it's hot enough, if it's humid enough, if you, had the poor judgment to leave it on the counter wrapped in plastic, that mold could literally reduce a head of cabbage into a puddle of slime, and the puddle of slime, bears no resemblance whatsoever to delicious, crunchy, tangy sauerkraut. And so if a vegetable is exposed to air, molds are what are going to become dominant on that every single time. If, on the other hand, you manage to submerge the cabbage under liquid, then the molds can't grow because they don't have access to oxygen. And so what's going to grow instead are lactic acid bacteria. And the lactic acid bacteria are going to give it a nice tangy flavor. And then they're going to make it impossible for any of the bacteria that we would regard as pathogenic bacteria to remain alive, even if they were present on the cabbage in the first place. And by the way, the most the bacteria that creates a toxin, which is considered the substance most toxic to humans of any other substance, Clostridium botulinum, that produces a toxin that we know as botulism, it's a common soil bacteria. It's everywhere, and it probably is present on every head of cabbage. But the only environmental condition in which Clostridium botulinum ever has the possibility of proliferating and creating that toxin is if you heat it up to the point where you kill all the other bacteria. One of the things that distinguishes Clostridium botulinum is that it has the sporulating form that is extremely heat resistant, and it can even resist boiling temperatures. And so that's why in canning it's important to pressure cook things, because you elevate the temperature even higher than boiling, and you have to hold it there for a certain amount of time in order to kill all the Clostridium botulinum, because if you manage to kill all the other bacteria, you don't have to worry about this in the fermentation context at all, because the lactic acid bacteria are so much more prevalent in every single time time you submerge cabbages underwater, they will what will dominate, and as they acidify the environment, they'll kill off the Clostridium botulinum that might be present. The only time it ever has the opportunity to develop is in improperly heated canned food. So if you can something, heat it to the point where everything else dies, the lactic acid bacteria dies, the mold spores die, the only thing that survives is Clostridium botulinum, and you've left it in this perfect vacuum, the perfect anaerobic environment that it needs in order to proliferate, then the Clostridium botulinum grows. And the only reason we all know the word botulism is because, in the context of canning, which was, you know, invented like almost exactly 200 years ago, a Frenchman named Nicolas Appert, invented the process for, canning, sterilization. And so, during the 19th and early 20th century, there were all of these, scandalous stories where entire families died eating a jar of, canned string beans or whatever that hadn't been subjected to quite enough heat. This is just to illustrate that, on all plant matter, there is a multitude of microorganisms, not just a single one, and there is sort of, there's an inevitability of our having to deal with these organisms. Fermentation or microbial transformations, because fermentation specifically describes anaerobic organisms, and there are anaerobic as well as aerobic organisms on everything, microbial transformations of our food are an inevitability. And so, either our food decomposes into forms that are not at all palatable to us, or else we figure out how to, harness the power of the microorganisms to turn the food into something that is, more delicious, more stable, more digestible, or, in some ways, better. Than it was. Coexisting with microorganisms is a biological imperative. The fermentation arts are the human cultural manifestations of this biological imperative. So as we evolved with bacteria, as human cultural practices evolved, they evolved in the context of the reality that bacteria and fungi were part of all of our food. And we, even though it's only in the last, 150 years that we have been, sort of specifically conceptualizing it as, microorganisms, they still were no less of a reality that people had to deal with. And this is why, cultures all around the world, I do not know about every single cultural tradition, culinary tradition that exists around the world, but I've looked really hard for a counterexample of any kind of, culinary tradition that does not incorporate any kind of fermentation, and I can't find any, and I have come to firmly believe that they just could not exist because of this, sort of inevitability of the presence of fermenting organisms or all sorts of organisms on our food. Now let me talk a little bit about culture. Culture is a big word. Culture describes, science and language and literature and music and religious practices and beliefs and, thank you. And the totality of all the people seek to pass down from generation to generation. When we look at the word culture, it comes from Latin for cultivation. And the idea is that the origins of culture or whatever are is related to the cultivation of the soil and the development of ideas about how to do that. We're developing techniques that we are passing down and all that comes with that. Then we also use the same word to describe little communities of bacteria. So, you know, when we make yogurt and transfer a scoop of mature yogurt containing not only yogurt, but these bacteria that have turned the milk into yogurt, and we introduce that into new milk, we call that a culture, and we call the act of introducing it into the milk is culturing. So I think it's fascinating that we use the same word to describe these little, you know, communities of bacteria that we have harnessed to transform our food, that we use to describe this, you know, sort of totality of everything that we seek to pass down from generation to generation. And as it turns out, you know, in so many human cultures, these cultured foods are really central to culinary traditions and even to cultural identity. So many cultures around the world have very distinctive foods that people within the culture are acculturated to be able to enjoy. And yet people from outside of the culture who might come and visit or might be exposed to the culture are often very put off by some of these foods. So one culture's, you know, sort of highest expression of their culinary arts is often, you know, the worst nightmare of somebody who's outside of the culture. And actually, I mean, I was recently reading about a Hawaiian and South Pacific ferment called poi, which is fermented taro. And I was reading an anthropologist's account from the 1930s. And, you know, the anthropologist who was writing this paper found the poi so horribly distasteful that he speculated that there must be like a gene, a poi gene, that, you know, sort of enabled the South Pacific Islanders to enjoy this food that was just so intrinsically repulsive to this European guy. But really, it's not, you know, there's not a poi gene, there's not a Limburger cheese gene, there's not a natto gene, there's not a fish sauce gene. You know, it's just what you're used to. And I think we probably all can relate to the idea in the realm of cheese. I think we probably all can, you know, probably, you know, half of us or a third of us in this room love stinky cheeses. And, you know, once in a while we'll go and, go to a gourmet food store that, you know, sells a bunch of different cheeses and, you know, splurge on a chunk of really stinky cheese, and we'll invite some friends over to share that with us. But guess what? Not all of our friends like that. You know, some people don't even want to be in the same room because they find the smell of it just so utterly offensive, and they could never even consider putting it in their mouths. And, you know, the world is full of these foods that, you know, to a certain portion of the population, you know, or people who were raised around the food is just like as good as it gets. And for, you know, people who are not familiar with it, it's just, you know, scary. It smells like death or rotting or, you know, something that's scary to them. Something else that I want to address, which Shoshi specifically expressed interest in is the role of fermentation in ritual and religious iconography. And because the defining characteristic of fermentation is bubbles. You know, when you set up a fermentation, you sort of watch it come to life. I mean, literally, it is coming to life. But that's been, you know, that's been really understood in many indigenous cultures around the world as a very, you know, kind of magical event. You know, the introduction of life forces to the, to whatever the, you know, liquid substrate usually that's being turned into an alcoholic beverage is. So there's, you know, lots of examples of, you know, cultures that had elaborate ritual around it. You know, in some cases, it was understood that, you know, people had to teach the ferment how to dance. So, you know, people would make a lot of noise and dance around it, and basically, you know, teach it how to be active and do that until it got active. And then in some other places, they approached it in exactly the opposite way, where they felt like, you know, it needed to be undisturbed, it needed quiet and reverence. And so people would leave it alone and had a very different understanding of it. If you look at the pantheons of different, pantheistic religions to which there is, you know, surviving documentation. I mean, in Egypt there was a goddess of beer, Ninkasi, and in Lithuania there was a god of pickles, Rogusi. So, you know, lots of pantheistic belief systems, you know, have some sort of specific god or goddesses or more than one of them. In Greek mythology, there was Bacchus, who was the god of wine. But, you know, even in our modern day, you know, monotheistic religions, well, you know, in Islam there's a prohibition on alcohol. In Judaism we say a prayer, Bore Pari Hagafen, you know, blessed is the creator of the fruit of the vine, and we repeat it with, you know, multiple with multiple drinks of wine. And in the Roman Catholic Mass, you know, what is it that is, you know, transubstantiated from the blood of Jesus Christ? It's wine. So you know, even in our, you know, contemporary monotheistic world religions, you know, fermented products of fermentation continue to have a really central place in our religious iconography. I want to mention one other aspect of culture, which is technology. The McDonald's brought this beautiful kraut shredding device, which you can see in the back of the room, and that's that one that they have there is probably a 19th century shredding device, but you know, the desire for fermented foods and beverages has given rise to incredible amounts of innovation. And you know, if you try to imagine the roots of pottery, I mean, you know, what greater incentive could there have been for people to, you know, develop the technology of ceramic vessels than to have vessels to ferment liquid in? So, you know, humans didn't invent fermentation. I mean, you know, there's lots of documentation of all sorts of animals being attracted to fermenting fruit, and even documentation of animals becoming inebriated from gorging on fermented fruit. And we can certainly, surmise that our primate ancestors, in the African jungle were, you know, occasionally enjoying the pleasures of gorging themselves with fermented fruit. But what's really the uniquely human achievement is, you know, figuring out how to make it happen, so you don't have to wait for it to spontaneously occur during those over ripening moments when they do spontaneously occur. So it's humans largely because we created vessels that could contain these things. Claude Lévi-Strauss, you know, who does lots of speculating about the origins of culture, you know, has some interesting speculation about the origins of alcoholic beverages. And he basically calls, you know, a hollowed out tree that will hold water is like the transitional object from nature to culture. And I'm not sure I follow along with his argument the whole way, but this, you know, idea that it's a significant moment when people realize that rather than just sort of, you know, waiting to find, you know, a beehive of filled with honey to wash out from a tree during a storm and sort of get diluted in a puddle and have someone taste it and say like, oh, that's really good, oh, that's making me feel good, when people began to intentionally do that, climb up in a tree and harvest the hive with honey, you know, find some sort of a vessel to place it in and dilute it with water, bring some intentionality to the process. So, you know, a lot of our cultural development, a lot of our technology that we've developed, really has been in response to this, this burning desire for, fermented beverages and other types of products of fermentation. Now I just want to talk a little bit about my third theme, community. Microorganisms, as I mentioned earlier, never exist in sort of, singular, isolated species. You never find just yeast, Saccharomyces, all on its own. You never find, Lactobacillus just on its own. Microorganisms, like all other forms of life, exist in communities with interactions. I think it's a really, important concept. I mean, the thrust of, the literature of fermentation and the science of fermentation throughout the 20th century, including the esteemed Dr. Steinkraus, has all been all about, isolating individual organisms. And in many cases, it's been about, how can we, improve upon an indigenous practice that people have been doing and enjoying within their communities? How can we sort of look at what they've been doing and pull out the important organisms and then do that in a more hygienic way in a factory with more efficient production? And all around the world, part of part of the process of, cultures being destroyed and of cultural homogenization has been sort of, killing off the, indigenous community-based fermentation processes and moving these things into factory production, which, has the result of, disempowering people and breeding dependence on, on a product that they have to buy that they previously had been able to create for themselves. Food is really something. Food and beverages brings people together. When communities of people, when families, any groups of people come together, it is most often around food. Food is one of the greatest community builders that there are. The process of growing food, transforming the raw products of agriculture into the foods that people actually like to eat, these are all community activities. We have this little myth of total self-sufficiency, one family, goes off into the woods and sort of, creates a homestead, grows all of their own food, mills their own grain, bakes their own bread, and that it's exactly a myth. It's impossible. How can anyone do all of that on their own? We could have local food self-sufficiency, we could have regional food self-sufficiency, but, it's got to be a community activity. If it takes a village to raise a child, what does it take to have a well-rounded diet? It takes lots of people doing lots of different things. And, the fermentation arts are all extraordinarily simple at their basis. They're all ancient rituals that people have been doing forever. Or for a longer time than we know, because the origins of the ferments are not documented at all, because they predate recorded history. They're prehistoric. The earliest written documents in different languages refer to the ferments that already existed in those traditions. But it's given rise to a huge amount of specialization. So, any of us could, learn how to brew beer. We could learn how to, make some basic cheeses. We could learn how to make sauerkraut. Any of these, popular ferments. But it's not realistic that any one of us could do all of those things or learn how to do them all with any level of proficiency or do them regularly. Even when we're talking about, reviving local production, we're talking about sort of, rebuilding webs in our communities, webs of food production and webs of exchange. And, you know, in terms of the broader agenda that I'm interested in, which is, you know, reclaiming our food, you know, bringing production, you know, back to earth, recreating alternatives to mass-produced foods, you know, really for the you know, since the Second World War, the development, you know, first in the U.S. and then the rest of the world, or most of the rest of the world following suit, has been centralizing production, mass production of food. As far as I can tell, the mass production of food has been a failure. And we need to, we need to revive the ideas of regional and local production of food. It's been, you know, it's been a failure because, you know, it's producing nutritionally diminished food that's making us sick. You know, right now, for the first time in American history, demographers are thinking that our children's lifespans are likely to be shorter than ours, and one of the reasons for this is the, you know, diminished nutritional quality of the food that we're eating. The means by which we are mass producing food is, you know, polluting the earth, depleting water resources, polluting the water, creating new forms of pollution like genetic pollution that we don't really know how to deal with. The way that the centralized production of food and the transportation of it, it uses a huge amount of energy. And, you know, as long as that energy is available and cheap, I mean, I guess there's thousands of products in every supermarket that we can buy, but, you know, that's a big if. Following the logic of, you know, peak oil and the idea that, you know, oil is becoming, rarer and more expensive, both in monetary terms and in environmental terms, to extract from the earth. What are the implications of that on food prices and on food availability? And beyond the fuel involved in transporting food vast distances, there's the question of vulnerability to disruptions, all sorts of disruptions, whether it's from natural disasters or extreme weather events or wars or terrorism or other kinds of political violence, and basically being dependent on food resources far away, you know, just makes us exceedingly vulnerable. So really, like, I think that, you know, for me, the big picture of why fermentation is important and why reskilling people with the ability to ferment food for themselves isn't so everybody can make everything for themselves, but it's so that it's because that's such an integral part of redeveloping community, local, regional food self-sufficiency. I mean, people don't just eat the raw products of agriculture. You know, people love to eat all the things that you turn the raw products of agriculture into. And these are largely fermented products. So anyway, I could really go on and on, but it'll be much more interesting and fun if we make this a little bit interactive. So does anyone have any questions or comments or bones to pick or things they want to argue about or anything? Okay.
Started off with pH as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So it can't grow in an acidic environment. I mean, one of the reasons why acidification is such a brilliant strategy for food preservation is because it's also a strategy for food safety. And, you know, not only botulism, but, you know, E. coli, especially E. coli 0157 and salmonella and listeria and, you know, really any of the food poisoning organisms that any of us have heard the names of, you know, can't grow in an acidic environment. So that's another reason why fermentation is so safe. I mean, fermented vegetables, as far as I can tell, are the safest food that exists on this earth. They're certainly safer than raw vegetables. And according to the USDA, there has never been a single case of food poisoning reported in the United States from food poisoning. From fermented vegetables. So how many foods could you say that about? I mean, you certainly couldn't say that about raw vegetables or fruits or meats. or nuts. I mean, you know, every year, you know, we read all these accounts of, you know, spinach, lettuce, tomatoes, almonds, apples. I mean, it's one thing after another. So, you know, obviously, incidental contamination is a reality. You know, you have a farm that's growing lettuce in fields, and then there's a, you know, farm a little bit uphill where there's, you know, animals in confinement, and some of their manure trickles down the hill, gets on the lettuce leaves, and you know, there's always the potential for raw foods to get contaminated. If you took the contaminated vegetables and chopped them up and salted them and stuffed them into a crock to make sauerkraut out of them, the proliferation of lactic acid bacteria would overwhelm the incidental contaminants, and then as the environment acidified, the contaminating bacteria would be destroyed. So that's why there's never been a case of food poisoning reported from fermented vegetables. I mean, it's not that it's impossible for, you know, cabbages or other vegetables that you might incorporate into your sauerkraut to become contaminated. It's that even if they are contaminated, sauerkraut has this like sort of built-in defense strategy. I mean, acidification is a, you know, just hugely important means of protection. In fact, human reproduction would not be possible without lactic acid fermentation. I mean, basically, in women's vaginas, there are populations of lactobacilli, and actually, women's bodies produce a specific carbohydrate, glycogen, to support those populations, and it's the acidification by those lactobacilli that facilitate effective human reproduction. And then the flip side of that is that when babies are born, you know, when their fetus is in the womb, they're in a sterile environment, but it's sort of, you know, in their transit out of the womb that they first get populated by bacteria. And so, you know, the first bacteria that babies get exposed to are lactic acid bacteria. And then, of course, they continue to get exposed to lactic acid bacteria as they're breastfeeding. And it's that sort of, you know, buildup of lactic acid bacteria and other bacteria in their guts that enable them to begin to digest solid food. So, you know, human beings have a very, very intimate relationship with lactic acid bacteria in particular. And that's why, you know, live culture lactic acid fermented foods, can be so beneficial to our health, because there are all these factors in our contemporary lives, chemicals in our contemporary lives, antibiotic drugs, antibacterial cleansing products, chlorinated water, that have the accumulated result of assaulting the bacteria in our guts on a daily basis. And so, you know, it's just become important to, replenish, diversify those populations, and fermented foods are a really great way of doing that. Are there any other comments, questions, challenges? Okay, question about Ayurvedic practitioners saying that too much fermented foods create too much acidity and inflammation. One thing about eating acidic live cultured foods is, even though they are acidic, because they make minerals so much more bioavailable, they actually have the net effect of alkalinizing us, even though they are acidic. Now, I mean, I'm not advocating that everybody just eat fermented foods. I mean, too much of a good thing can be a bad thing. I mean, it's really important to eat fresh vegetables too. There's been a little bit of a correlation in some places in Asia between high consumption of salty preserved vegetables and esophageal cancers, but basically, when they look at like the elevated levels of cancers are among people who like eat almost exclusively fermented vegetables as their source of vegetables. And once you look at people who eat a balance between fermented vegetables and non-fermented fresh vegetables, then you see that there's no elevation of esophageal cancer. I don't think it's really of any benefit to eat only fermented foods. But first of all, I mean, in many places, especially historically in the wintertime, that has been the fresh vegetables that people have had available to them. But I think, you know, in our time, where, you know, even in the context of revival of local agriculture in a temperate place like this that has a limited growing season, you know, we have hoop houses now. You know, there's ways that people can have. Some fresh vegetables, and fermented vegetables, really all year around. Now, in terms of Ayurveda, it's interesting because, I have heard this idea that Ayurvedic medicine sort of has a bias against fermented foods. But, what I've learned is that there's a whole branch of Ayurvedic medicine where they make medicinal preparations out of different kinds of plants, where the plants are fermented. Like that's integral to making the medicine, because they understand that the fermentation transforms the medicinal actions of different plants and phytochemicals just through the fact that they're fermented. So I mean, Ayurveda is not unilaterally opposed to fermented vegetable to fermentation, but moderation is a really good thing for any of us to keep in mind. Alcoholic beverages are beloved, but it's really important to enjoy them with a sense of moderation. Same with fermented vegetables, fermented soybeans, and really any vegetable.
That's what. So I have pretty good luck with kimchi and sauerkraut and those kinds of things. But I find that it's a pithier proposition in terms of fermenting things like cucumbers or green tomatoes. So I'm just wondering if you have some tricks that.
Yeah, sure. So cucumbers are pretty much the most challenging vegetable to ferment. And one reason is that they're so watery. Another reason is that the time when they're ripe is the time when temperatures are highest. The best vegetables for preservation are vegetables that ripen when it's cool. Cucumbers ripen when it's hot. The best method that I've used for keeping, and really the issue is that they get mushy. Okay, so it's not that they like get toxic or taste horrible. It's that they lose their nice crunchiness and get really mushy. And so, a basic conceptual idea is that all living things contain the enzymes to digest themselves. Vegetables all contain enzymes that, digest the vegetables in different ways. So there are these pectinase enzymes that exist in vegetables that digest the pectins. And so when cucumbers get really mushy, it's really because of the pectinase enzymes. One solution is to find a cool fermentation spot. So like, an unheated cellar is kind of ideal. Okay.
What about grape leaves?
Grape leaves. So there are all these tannin-rich leaves seem to inhibit these enzymes. So grape leaves, oak leaves, sour cherry leaves. I've also used tea bags when I couldn't find any of those things. Those are techniques for keeping the cucumbers crunchier for longer. When I make cucumber pickles in the summertime, I typically in Tennessee heat, where it's generally 95 degrees every afternoon when the cucumbers are ripe, I ferment them for just 2 or 3 days and then I move them to refrigerator. So it's not whereas when I make
you know, sauerkraut from cabbage or from radishes in the, you know, in November, you know, I'm still eating that, and I'll be eating that up until, you know, June or July, and it, you know, and it's got a perfectly wonderful texture. So, you know, it's really like a short fermentation time with these tannin-rich leaves, and then getting them into a cool spot. A really short fermentation time compared to anything else.
And what's the ideal temperature range for long-term storage of cucumber?
I would say, you know, earth temperature, 55 degrees, 55 to 60 degrees.
So there are a lot of sort of industrially produced fermented foods. Then you go to the Green Star and you see the kombucha that's sold all across the country. I don't personally think it's as good as the homemade stuff. I'm curious if there's a trade-off between ramping up production and maintaining the cultural integrity of the products?
Well, that is a great question. Okay, so some of you probably remember that maybe a year and a half ago, there was a big sort of scare about kombucha, and it was removed from the shelves of a lot of stores, most notably Whole Foods. And that was because, you know, I guess it was the FDA sampled some bottles and found alcohol levels that were above 0.5%, which is the, you know, cutoff for foods or beverages to be marketed not as alcoholic beverages. And so actually many people who were producing kombucha stopped using the, you know, sort of traditional culture for making kombucha, which is a kombucha, kefir, and a couple of other ferments are really notable for their cultures because their cultures have evolved into really distinctive physical forms. So if any of you have ever seen a mother of kombucha, it's this like rubbery disc that, you know, floats at the top of the sweet tea that it's fermenting. It begins as just a thin film, but it gets thicker and thicker, and I mean, I've seen them this thick, you know, floating on top of the of the sweet tea. So, and that's it, and it's a community of organisms. It's called a SCOBY in the literature, S-C-O-B-Y, symbiotic community of bacteria and yeast. And so you know, this is what defines kombucha. Another SCOBY is kefir. It's a little, looks like a little florets of cauliflower, and they're called kefir grains or sometimes kefir curds. And similarly, it's a community of organisms. The kefir community has been much studied. Lynn Margulis identified more than 30 distinct microorganisms that are present in the kefir community. But, you know, sometimes these SCOBYs are challenging for commercial production because it's very difficult to standardize. So you will not find a commercial kefir for sale in the United States that, you know, I think is worthy of being called kefir because they're not made with SCOBY, which is, you know, what has historically defined this food. Instead, you know, some microbiologists like looked under the microscope and, you know, sort of like pulled off a few of the organisms that are present in kefir. And so now kefir that's commercially available is a cultured milk product made with a few of the individual organisms that were extracted from kefir grains, but not with the full community, because one of the organisms in the community in kefir is Saccharomyces cerevisiae yeast that transforms lactose into alcohol. When you're trying to sell a fermented milk product in a natural food store and market it for children, it becomes problematic if it has more than 0.5% alcohol. And, you know, typically kefir will have, you know, 0.8% alcohol or maybe 1.1% alcohol. I mean, you would need to drink an awful lot of it to, you know, feel the alcohol, but nonetheless, it is present. So it creates, you know, huge regulatory challenges. Plus, your starter is something that keeps growing. So, you know, if you're trying to standardize production, have exactly the same length of time for each batch, if your starter keeps growing, it's really, really hard to standardize it. So basically, the way people, at least in the United States context, have gotten around this is they've just extracted a few organisms from that. They call that, you know, kefir starter. You can buy different powdered kefir starters that I think it should be illegal to call kefir. I mean, they might be perfectly wonderful cultured milk products, but, you know, kefir is this, you know, community of organisms from the Caucasus Mountains that is, you know, sort of embodied in a physical form that is evolved. I mean, there have also been, you know, multitude of experiments in laboratories where people take as many of these individual organisms as they can and then like put them together in a test tube and try to, you know, create a new life out of them and get and create a new kefir brand, and nobody's been able to do it. I mean, you know, it's like kefir begets kefir the way elephants beget elephants. You know, it's like nobody's been able to create it in a laboratory. But anyway, going back to kombucha, a lot of the kombucha manufacturers now, you know, because there's this sort of problem with alcohol in the kombucha sometimes. I mean, really, as long as kombucha is exposed to air, alcohol doesn't accumulate. There's always going to be traces of alcohol, but because it's exposed to air, alcohol exposed to air turns into acetic acid. There are bacteria called Acetobacter that consume alcohol and transform it into acetic acid. But as soon as you seal it into a bottle, then there are yeast as part of that community that do produce alcohol. So when you seal it into a bottle and there's no longer a flow of oxygen, then you start to have greater potential for alcohol accumulation. And that's what happened with the ones that caused this big scare. But as a result, many of the manufacturers have ceased using the traditional kombucha culture and instead are using various extracts of a few of the organisms from the traditional kombucha culture and leaving out the yeast and other ones that might be perceived as being problematic. So there are a lot of fermented foods that are being marketed that are really they have live cultures. It's not that they're bad things. It's just that they are not the things that they are purporting to be. They're not the things that sort of have historically defined those particular foods. So I think that there's that. And then there's also just, this is, fermented foods are like the ultimate in localism and the specificity of place. And I think that, cheeses are an especially good illustration of this because, all of these, kind of crazy different kinds of cheeses that exist. And, really what we can find in, fancy cheese stores in the United States is, like just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, a couple of years ago, I went to this international slow food gathering in Italy called Terra Madre, and one of the things that Slow Foods is doing is sort of trying to promote and protect foods that are perceived as being at some risk of extinction, and so. There were all these really obscure cheeses like I'd never seen before. I mean, there were cheeses where the sort of wrapping was the bark of a tree. There were cheeses where the wrapping was the skin of an animal. I mean, it was really just like extraordinary range of styles of cheese making. But really, ultimately, they're defined by the pastures on which different animals are grazing and the seasons in which they're being milked, and more than anything, by the environments in which they are being aged. And so, historically, specific cheeses were just produced in specific places. And, now in Europe, they have this sort of, legal mechanism for, protecting certain foods that, you can only use the name of the food in that particular place. But as a practical matter, there are all of these, catalogs and suppliers where you can buy all these different cheese cultures. And so, you can buy, like the culture for a camembert. I mean, that evolved as a response to a specific set of environmental conditions. But now, you can buy that culture and make cheese with it. And so, most cheesemakers are really trying to replicate certain classic styles of cheese, which is wonderful. I mean, the classic styles of cheese are great. But, you know, because each cheese sort of evolved as a specific response to specific environment, there are lots of cheeses that are not being made because, you know, a smaller and smaller group of them are the sort of, you know, popular cheeses that are being widely copied and manufactured and marketed. But there are many more cheeses that are not being copied and marketed. And so there's actually this very interesting woman, Marcelino is her last name. She's a cheesemaker who got interested in microbiology and got a PhD in microbiology. And she's been basically writing about the loss of biodiversity in cheeses. So, you know, as people are, you know, focused more and more on a limited number of cheeses and, you know, sort of buying those specific cultures, there are all these other cheeses that are just falling by the wayside. And all these cultures, I mean, you know, basically, fresh milk, as you know, most of us grew up drinking it. I mean, it's a 20th century phenomenon. It's only possible to have, you know, widespread enjoyment of fresh milk if you have widespread refrigeration. And so, you know, really the origin of all cheeses is just the inevitable process of milk souring. And so, you know, most people throughout history and most people still in the world, what the milk that they've had access to is sour milk. And there's been all this diversity of sour milks. And so we have a word in English that's become really kind of obsolete, clabbered milk. And that really means, you know, like raw milk left out will acidify and thicken itself just through bacterial processes. But, you know, clabbered milk in, you know, different environments and different seasons will have very different kinds of flavors. And so when people have clabbered milk that they especially liked, they would take a little bit of that sour milk and introduce that into the next batch of milk. And in the technical literature, that's called backslopping. You take a little bit of the last batch and introduce that into the next batch, and that can be a continuous process. So all around the world, like everywhere where people domesticated ruminant animals for their milk, people drank sour milk, and all these distinctive styles of sour milk developed. Now that yogurt has become this globalized process, I mean, basically the only vocabulary we have for talking about these is to refer to them as yogurts. So, you know, to use another slow food example, there's a fermented milk in a region of Kenya. It's very distinctive. It's always fermented in a gourd. They add the ash of a particular plant to it, as part of the process and part of like creating a selective environment. And slow food is championing this, but they can only call it, like the only word they have is to call it is Kenyan yogurt. It has nothing to do with yogurt whatsoever. It's a different fermented milk. But, you know, like all processes of cultural homogenization, like language is dying, everybody speaking a smaller number of languages, like the same thing is happening with these milks, where, you know, all of these distinctive styles of cultured, sour, fermented milks are sort of falling by the wayside as more and more people are embracing the, you know, kind of dominant global commodities like yogurt. And I mean yogurt, no disrespect by saying this. And, you know, just another note on yogurt that people who have been coming to a couple of talks have already heard me talk about, but I will go ahead and repeat it. How many people here have ever tried to make yogurt? Okay, I mean, it's something that like a lot of people experiment with. And if you go buy a package of yogurt at the store, you know, you buy plain, you know, Stonyfield, Dannon, whatever kind of yogurt, and you take a little scoop of that, you heat up your milk, you cool it down to 110, you introduce that milk, you create some sort of an incubation chamber to try to maintain it around 110 degrees for several hours. And you can make beautiful yogurt, and then out of that yogurt, you could make another batch of yogurt. But as you get into like the third batch and the fourth batch, like suddenly the yogurt's not staying so thick anymore. And it's just like with the kefir and the kombucha. You know, yogurt has been a community of organisms, And microbiologists at the Pasteur Institute at the beginning of the 20th century, you know, looked at yogurt under the microscope and decided, like, you know, this one, Lactobacillus bulgaricus, or, and this one, Streptococcus thermophilus. Like, these are, you know, the important bacteria for yogurt that make yogurt thicken, when there were lots of other bacteria there. So all of the commercial yogurts, starting with, you know, the Danone company in Barcelona in 1919, have been like making yogurt out of, you know, selected, you know, individual strains of bacteria. I mean, they combine a couple or two or three or four different bacteria, but that's not the same as an evolved community that has inherent stability and defense strategies to protect it from other kinds of bacteria and other, you know, forms of life that can attack bacteria. So these evolved communities have elaborate defense strategies. So traditional yogurts, you know, people got the culture from their, you know, grandmother who got it from her grandmother, and it just like passed down from generation to generation. When people try to make yogurt with contemporary supermarket yogurt, you can make wonderful yogurt for a generation or two, and then everybody has to go back to the store and buy another cup of yogurt to do another generation or two. You know, so these traditional mixed cultures really are, you know, they're easier to propagate because they have this, you know, there is this like community dynamics and community stability. And once we isolate individual organisms, and you know, I mean, it can have practical benefit. You know, I'm sure for yogurt manufacturers, it's much more sort of consistent and predictable to work with, you know, a couple of isolated bacteria than to work with a community. But for you know, people who are household or community level practitioners, it is, you know, it is ultimately a disempowering process, because, you know, a generalist cannot, you know, isolate individual bacteria and propagate individual bacteria effectively. So now, you know, instead of, you know, being able to, you know, just continue propagating the you know, culture received from, you know, your great grandmother, you know, you have to keep on going and buying another starter. And you know, really, like the whole thrust of, you know, fermentation science and fermentation literature throughout the 20th century has been all about this, like isolating individual organisms in the name of, you know, improved production. I mean, to me, it's exactly analogous to the process of you know, hybrid seeds replacing you know, sort of you know, seeds that farmers had saved over the course of generations that were well adapted to local conditions. You know, the seed breeders, you know, created seeds that did have improvements, and under ideal circumstances, you know, they would give, you know, higher yields or, you know, bigger vegetables or, you know, other types of improvements. But you know, not everyone's farm is ideal conditions. So what it meant is, you know, people had to put in irrigation systems. And so, you know, that's expensive and ultimately has ended up depleting water resources. You know, they're not as well adapted to, you know, local pests or fungi. So then people need to, you know, buy chemicals to put on those. And then you have to buy the seeds themselves, because it's not within the, you know, realm of what a generalist farmer can do to sort of, you know, create their own hybrid seeds. So, you know, we've replaced a process that was self-perpetuating with a process where, you know, the practitioners are disempowered and forced to sort of, you know, purchase a product from some experts who know how to do it. So you know, that's been the thrust of the fermentation science and literature, you know, through the 20th century. And you know, what my interest is, and what, you know, the books that I've been writing are all about, the opposite. We're trying to help empower people with skills to you know, take back these processes and start doing them in their homes. And there are still heirloom yogurt cultures available. And you know, the internet actually has turned out to be an amazing tool for spreading things like that around. So, you know, after years of occasionally making yogurt and then feeling discouraged when it stopped working after a couple of generations, a couple of years ago, I got a hold of an heirloom yogurt culture, you know, on the internet, culturesforhealth.com, And, you know, I estimate that I've done 45 generations so far with the same yogurt culture. And, you know, just each batch is just as, you know, thick and delicious as the previous batch was. In February, I had the opportunity to go to Indonesia, and I got to visit a village where they make tempeh. Now, I've been making tempeh for 15 years, and I always use a pure culture starter, Rhizopus oligosporus varsaito, which Dr. Steinkraus actually gave to the USDA. So there's a USDA culture collection, and it has this sort of, you know, one... strain of Rhizopus oligosporus, and all of the tempeh that's been manufactured commercially in the United States has been made with this single strain. And, you know, I've you know, sort of learned how to propagate the single strain, and it really, you know, kind of strains my abilities as a, you know, generalist without a laboratory to be able to propagate the single strain. I, you know, have to use a pressure cooker, and, you know, it's, you know, I have to, you know, kind of wipe down everything and just make sure things are, you know, as, well, I mean, obviously it's not sterile in my kitchen, but, you know, things are as sanitized as possible. And then, you know, I've had mixed results. Sometimes I get it, sometimes I don't. Usually I end up just buying my tempeh starter from a mail order source. But when I went to Indonesia, you know, what I found in this village where they make tempeh is like a leaf. They sandwiched some inoculated soybeans between two leaves. They over-ripened it. Dried it in the sun. When they opened it up, you see two colors of sporulation. You see black, which is the color of the sporulation of Rhizopus oligosporus, and I saw yellow, which is the color of sporulation of Aspergillus fungi. And then, you know, also just because it was in an open environment, there's all sorts of bacteria. And so, you know, you use that to inoculate the soybeans. You make beautiful tempeh that actually has like a more, you know, a more complex flavor to it. And then when you need more starter, you just take some of those inoculated soybeans, put them between two leaves, and it's easy for a generalist to propagate. And just, you know, conceptually, you know, for any ferment to be a sort of, you know, a continuous process, you know, from whatever its origins are to the present, you know, people didn't have microscopes, people didn't have sterile laboratories, people had to be able to propagate these things themselves. And, you know, whatever the improvements might be for commercial production to have isolated, pure cultures, they're not, you know, they're not better for the home practitioner. Mixed cultures are much, much easier to work with because there's this like community stability that's kind of inherent in, you know, groups of organisms that have evolved together.
Oh. I'm curious about your new book that's coming out and sort of what ideas you're able to develop in some projects as well.
Well, I mean, you know, kind of some of what I've just been talking about. I mean, this sort of, you know, pure culture versus mixed culture idea. My opening chapter is called "Fermentation as a Co-Evolutionary Force," and some of the stuff that I started out talking about. You know, I develop more. But really, more than anything, I mean, it's another book that's, you know, how to ferment things yourself. And it's a book that, you know, I couldn't have written in 2001 when I wrote Wild Fermentation. It's, you know, I mean, any book is like a little slice in time. And, you know, I mean, anyone who writes a book, you know, hopefully is someone who's like, you know, continuing to take in information and learn things. And so, you know, in 2001, I had 8 years of experience fermenting. And it was mostly just me and a few books that I found, and, you know, all of my friends that I would, you know, subject to my experiments. And then, you know, since the book came out, you know, I've just gotten to teach all over, and you know, I've gotten to talk to thousands of people, and I've, you know, had a website and had, you know, thousands of people write to me. So I mean, I just feel like, I mean, first of all, I know about a lot more different ferments. I've gotten a chance to experiment much more widely. But even more importantly, I've just gotten to hear people's stories about, you know, what their grandparents did, you know, what they did in the old country that they came from, you know, the food that they think about all the time that they missed that they haven't been able to find in the U.S., and also the problems that people encounter. So I feel like, you know, by answering troubleshooting questions, you know, via my website for a decade, I have gained a lot of insight into what the typical problems are, whether it's, you know, soft cucumbers, or, you know, why doesn't my yogurt work after two or three generations, or things like that. So, I mean, the new book is just, you know, it's more in-depth because, you know, my knowledge has become more in-depth. But, you know, really, mostly because, you know, I've gotten to talk to lots of people more than anything else. And also read a lot of books. You know, I had you know, like 2 hours in the Vanderbilt University Library to like skim through Dr. Steinkraus's book when I wrote Wild Fermentation, and then I finally bit the bullet and bought myself a copy. And it has been such an indispensable resource for me. And there's a huge literature of fermentation when you start, you know, looking around at, you know, what microbiologists have written, what you know, various social scientists have written. You know, I mean, I read this, like, you know, brilliant dissertation about the economic consequences of factory production of sorghum beer in Botswana. You know, and it turns out that, you know, in Botswana, you know, brewing beer was one of the, you know, best opportunities for women to earn a decent living. And basically, you know, moving it from community production to factory production, you know, has had huge economic repercussions for, you know, certainly for these women, and, you know, and for the people dependent on them, you know, and for the communities that they live in. So anyway, you know, I mean, more practice, more conversations, more reading, and it's a decade later, and I have more to say.
Yeah.
Well, the little bird told me that you're working on something with Patrick McGovern, and I'm wondering if you can divulge some details about that.
Oh, that's so funny. A little bird told her that I'm working on something with Patrick McGovern. I don't know, you know, we've had a nice correspondence. I mean, you know, he's someone I really admire. In June, I'm going to Philadelphia, and, you know, he's going to show me around, you know, the museum, and we're going to have lunch together, but maybe that'll turn out that we'll work on something, but I don't know about it yet.
Oh, okay.
I came a little late, so I'm sorry if you already addressed this. I'm just curious if... your talk kind of touched a few times on relationship of ferments to the body and relationships to the body. I'm curious if you have any insights into different cultures' use of ferments and different cultures' relationships to decay, to death, to body function. You know, I'm thinking stinky feet, smells like rot, all that kind of stuff.
Wow, okay, that's pretty big and broad. I mean, I'm not sure how to answer that question. I mean, you know, at the one level, there's, you know, sort of like it's a pattern repeated across so many cultures that, you know, fermented foods and in particular foods with live cultures were just sort of like understood by folklore to be, you know, especially supportive of health or, you know, or healing or magical foods in some way. At another level, there's like, you know, talking about stinky cheeses or something. I mean, people are always likening, you know, stinky cheeses to various, you know, body parts and things like that. And you know, a lot of the, you know, a lot of the squeamishness that people have about certain fermented foods is that, you know, it's sort of like it works that edge of what we're sort of like instinctively repulsed by, you know, the smells of death and decomposition, but it's sort of like working that edge. But I don't really know how to answer that question.
Fair enough.
In a slightly different direction, because I'm curious, when you were talking about the ferments and the body, I'm curious about how fermented products, say fermented communities are used in spa treatment or in other hygienic products that are starting to become part of an in vogue, marginalized sort of sector of healthcare that's not necessarily something you eat. I think there was a spa in...
Yeah, sure. Yeah, no, in Freestone, California, the Osmosis Day Spa.
Yeah.
I mean, basically, like, what they have is, like, tubs of rice bran and sawdust cultured and fermented and quite warm. And then, you know, once they're really active in generating heat, like they fill a tub with it, and there's a spa treatment where, you know, they basically like make a little space in the shape of, you know, you like laying down in it, and then you like lay down in it, and they cover you up, and it's incredibly hot. It's 140 degrees. I mean that. Well, the, I mean that the temperature, if you just stick a thermometer in there, is 140 degrees. Evidently, that, you know, it doesn't really heat your body to 140 degrees. I stayed in there for like, you know, about a half an hour or something. You know, you have like a host who, you know, comes and pampers you, like puts cold cloths on your forehead, gives you a little sort of bent straw with cold water to sip while you're in there. But I mean, it really is this amazing exfoliating feeling. I mean, it's literally like these bacteria eating the dead skin off your body. And, you know, it felt really great, and I felt, you know, really kind of like jelly when I got out of there.
Yes, we hear about mineralizing the body as a health regimen for hundreds of years. People go to incredible water sources that have unique mineral compositions, and they drink these waters, they bathe in them. But we can look at these bacterial communities as another way to treat our entire body, not just our digestive tract, with a community of helpers.
Well, and people also sometimes use ferments medicinally as poultices. And I actually met this elderly Russian-born woman in Australia when I was doing some workshops up there in Melbourne, and she told me this great story that her husband had skin cancer, and it was like a cancer in his ear. And he was scheduled for surgery to have this cancer removed. And one night she had a dream. Her grandmother came to her in her dream and reminded her that in Russia, you know, when people would have an infection or any kind of like, you know, skin irregularity, they would put a poultice of sauerkraut on it. So this woman, in, you know, in the morning, she told her husband about her dream, and he agreed to sort of let her put some poultices of sauerkraut, you know, on you know, this skin cancer in his ear, and it started shrinking, and then he ended up not having to have the surgery. And you know, it's well documented that sauerkraut, you know, has compounds called isothiocyanates that are considered to be potent anti-carcinogenic compounds. So, you know, it all kind of makes sense. But I mean, sure. I mean, I think you know, there's all sorts. I mean, you know, I've heard of people soaking their feet in vinegar to get rid of fungal infections on their feet. You know, there's lots of applications beyond just, you know, ingesting them to, you know, sort of, you know, use either the fermenting organisms themselves or their metabolic byproducts, you know, such as acetic acid, you know, in different kinds of topical medicinal ways. But yeah, and the osmosis day spa, they didn't invent that. I mean, that's something that's, you know, done in Japan. You know, from what I've been able to learn, it's, you know, something that was invented in this century in Japan. But, you know, it's practically like a Nuka pickle pot that you get inside of. That's so hard. What are my favorite fermented foods? I don't know. You know, I feel like, you know, it's like, what are your favorite, you know, which is your favorite child or something? I'm very devoted to sauerkraut. I mean, I really do love sauerkraut. I really do love beer. But I mean, I just like, I love experimenting. I mean, probably the fermented food that I eat, you know, the most frequently is I make these like savory vegetable sourdough pancakes. So, you know, I don't know, sometimes I'll go for weeks where like twice a day, you know, my meal is, you know, some sort of a, you know, vegetable, maybe a little cheese, grated into my sourdough, mixed in with an egg. And I make these pancakes, and I just never get tired of them. I always bury them a little bit. I love to eat those. What was my favorite? I don't know. I love cheese. Oh my god. I mean, I guess I would have to say like a really sort of like creamy, strong flavored cheese. You know, You know, but if I was going to be on a desert island with only, if I was stranded on an island with only one food, I would never take the stinky cheese. I mean, I'd probably stick with the sourdough pancakes or the sauerkraut, or both, you know.
So I'm curious, like, what would happen if you took your Dan and yogurt and you did a couple generations and it wasn't working? What if you just kept going? Would you get to a new community quickly enough? Would it take like 10 generations, 100, 1,000?
I don't know. I mean, evolution just isn't that predictable. I mean, if you have access to raw milk, I mean, you can just leave raw milk on the counter and it will, you know, it will sour itself. You know, you'll have cultured milk, clabbered milk. You know, but in terms of like a stable community, I mean, I don't think that that's that predictable, you know, how long that would take. I mean, you know, I mean, just conceptual. I mean, you know, the first yogurt, you know, nobody had a starter. You know, the first yogurt was a spontaneous event that occurred somewhere. The first kefir was a spontaneous event that occurred somewhere that, you know, somebody especially liked and you know, probably through some trial and error figured out how to propagate. But I mean, I just don't think that these events are that predictable. I mean, you know, in some environments, you could leave out milk, you know, every day for decades, and you know, just never get something that you like the taste of, or that, you know, sort of turns into a stable community. So I don't know, and I don't know enough about microbiology. I like, to be perfectly honest, I haven't taken a biology class since ninth grade. You know, I've read a lot of literature, but I'm you know, kind of missing certain, you know, sort of underlying concepts, and I just don't know. But I think that it would be like very, very unpredictable. Like, it could happen. You know, you could leave out raw milk in your kitchen and actually turn out to have something that you love much more than yogurt or kefir that, you know, could be the next big, you know, global sour milk product. But, you know, the likelihood is it wouldn't.
Well, you mentioned
sourdough,
so I'm just curious about the cultures that are available.
Yeah, so sourdoughs are really interesting, and in a way I would say that they're the exception to what I've been saying about stable communities, because you know, most of the research that I've found about sourdoughs, actually there's this New York State baker in the Hudson Valley, Daniel Leder, who's written a couple of really great books about bread. And he was out in California visiting a bunch of bakeries, and you know, somebody gave him some of their you know, famous San Francisco, you know, sourdough starter. And so he did this thing where he sent some of it directly to a laboratory for some microbial analysis, and then he took the rest of the sourdough that he was gifted with, you know, home on an airplane to New York State. He fed it a couple of times, baked some bread with it, and then took the starter that he had left and took some of that and sent it to the same lab for microbial analysis. And what he left California with wasn't what he had in New York a week later. Basically, the sourdough starter had become his environment. So between the flour that he was feeding to the sourdough and all grains have their own microbial ecosystem. You know, between what's on the flour and what's in his bakery, you know, basically the community in that sourdough was not stable. And yet, so even though sourdoughs are really different in different places depending on the environment, there's really only a couple of, you know, different, you know, genuses. I mean, it's basically the same genuses of organisms that are, or genera of organisms that are, you know, found in sourdoughs around the world. So there's a lot of similarity, but it's never the same, and you don't really get the same kind of community stability as you do in, you know, yogurt or tempeh or kombucha or kefir or, you know, some of these other types of ferments. So, you know, I mean, I've mostly started sourdoughs just from scratch. And then over the years, you know, different people have gifted me with, you know, their ancient family sourdoughs that, you know, somebody brought over from Europe with them and have been feeding, you know, over the course of generations. But, you know, really ultimately I found that they all end up tasting the same in my kitchen, and I just ended up like throwing them all together, and I just have this like bastard sourdough. I just, for a little while I was trying to maintain all these different sourdoughs, and then I just like realized like they all taste the same. You know, as distinct as they might have been when somebody left Europe with them, you know, 150 years ago, or, you know, wherever they came from, you know, just in the environment of my kitchen, you know, and fed the same flour that I used, they all sort of, you know, became the same, and so I just decided to throw them all together.
Is it the case though that it's not a stable community, or that it stabilized itself in your kitchen?
Yeah, sure.
That became its own local.
Yeah, I mean, except that, I mean, it seems like it's mostly about the substrate, like the flour that you feed it. So, you know, there's been some interesting, you know, microbial analysis within a bakery. And so, like, the rye sourdough will be a little bit different profile than the wheat sourdough, because you get, you know, sort of slightly different populations of organisms, you know, proliferating, you know, on each of those different plants. Yeah. Any more burning questions for anyone? Well, I thank you so much for your interest. If any of you you know, want to buy copies of either of my books that already exist, I have them right on that table, and I also have little postcards about who wrote The Art of Fermentation, and I encourage you to please check that out when that comes out. And I thank you all for your interest and attention.